you are standing at the precipice of both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say Black Lives Matter rather than All Lives Matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing progressive speakers to campuses and communities across the United States. If you enjoy the program, consider becoming a monthly patron to help us expand our reach and impact. For as little as $2 a month, you can gain access to special bonus audio commentaries unavailable anywhere else, as well as signed books and DVDs, among other goodies. And every donation is tax deductible, as it goes to Speak Out and help support their educational and activist mission. If you're interested, head over to www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise and help support progressive podcasting today. This episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise features the third of three public dialogues held at the National Conference on Race and Ethnicity in Higher Education, NCORE, held last month in New Orleans. In this conversation, I'll be speaking with David Pilgrim, Michael Benitez, and Loretta Ross, whose bios will be presented in the program itself, about the challenges currently facing college campuses when it comes to balancing the right to free speech, even for those espousing ideas that are racist, homophobic, sexist, or in other ways hurtful, with the rights of equal protection for all students, especially those targeted by hateful or prejudicial speech. What can campuses do to ensure the free and open exchange of ideas, while at the same time ensuring civility and promoting an equitable and just community where all students can feel respected and safe? Are there lines campuses can draw between speech that is protected and that which is disallowed? And if so, how do we determine those lines? Does the notion of free speech obligate campuses to provide platforms for any and all speakers, even when their views violate the stated mission and principles of the institution itself? And putting aside actual restrictions on certain speech acts, what actions can institutions of higher learning take proactively to minimize the damage of hateful activity on campus and create environments that are conducive to learning and community engagement? We'll talk about all that and more from the National Conference on Race and Ethnicity held last month in New Orleans on today's Speak Out with Tim Wise. And so let's get started. I'll jump in with the introductions of my fantastic panel. I'm going to start at the far end of the table. That is David Pilgrim. He is the founder and director of the Jim Crow Museum, which is the nation's largest publicly accessible collection of racist objects. It is located at Ferris State University, where he serves also as the vice president for diversity and inclusion. Dr. Pilgrim is also the author of Understanding Jim Crow, Using Racist Memorabilia to Teach Tolerance and Promote Social Justice. The book explains the museum's vision and work, where the objects are used as tools to teach about race, race relations, and racism. In 2004, Pilgrim produced, along with Clayton Rye, the documentary Jim Crow's Museum to explain his approach to battling racism. That film won several awards, including the Best Documentary at the 2004 Flint Film Festival. Jim Crow's Museum has shown nationally on PBS affiliates, including as part of the series The African Americans, Many Rivers to Cross. Please help me welcome David Pilgrim to the panel.
Thank you.
Sitting next to David is Michael Benitez, a nationally acclaimed activist, scholar, practitioner, and educator. He has served in higher education in different capacities over the last two decades, including academic and student affairs, equity and inclusion, Title IX, and teaching. Currently, he serves as the Dean of Diversity and Inclusion, Chief Diversity Officer, as well as Title IX Officer. So he basically is doing all the equity work, it sounds like, at the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma, Washington, where he provides leadership over the coordination, implementation, and assessment of operational and strategic goals related to diversity strategic planning and institutional efforts to foster and sustain an equitable campus climate. He is a highly sought-out speaker and workshop leader at colleges and conferences. He's also authored book chapters and articles on student identity, hip-hop culture, cultural centers, cultural and ethnic studies, institutional research and campus climate, and ways to support faculty of color. In previous roles, Dr. Benitez has served as the Director of Intercultural Development and the Black Cultural Center at Lafayette College, as adjunct faculty in the Graduate School of Leadership and Professional Advancement at Duquesne, as Director of Intercultural Engagement and Leadership at Grinnell, and as Director of Diversity Initiatives and Social Justice at Dickinson College. Please help me welcome Michael Benitez. And closest to me here is Loretta Ross, a nationally recognized leader in the field of human rights education and activism. Back to the show for the second time, which is wonderful. Had Loretta on earlier this year. You can catch that episode in some of the archives of the program. Loretta Ross is the co-author with Ricky Solinger of Reproductive Justice and Introduction, released in 2016 from the University of California Press. It was a first-of-its-kind primer that provides a comprehensive yet succinct description of the field of reproductive justice, putting the lives and lived experience of women of color at the center of the book, and using a human rights framework, reproductive justice provides an essential guide to understanding and mobilizing around women's rights in a period in which women's reproductive lives are imperiled. She is also the editor of Radical Reproductive Justice, which she reminded me came out the same year as Reproductive Justice, and the advice to the audience is never try to do two books in one year. It is never a good way to go. Ross is also the co-author of Undivided Rights, Women of Color Organize for Reproductive Justice, which received the Outstanding Book Award by the Gustavus Meyer Center for the Study of Bigotry and Human Rights. She's also the author of The Color of Choice chapter in Insight, Women of Color Against Violence. She has written extensively on the history of African-American women and reproductive justice activism. As a member of the Women's Media Center Progressive Women's Voices, Ross appears regularly in major media outlets about the issues of the day. She was co-founder and national coordinator from 2005 to 2012 of the Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Justice Collective, a network of women of color and allied organizations that organize women of color in the reproductive justice movement. So thank you, Loretta. Let's welcome her to the stage. And so the topic for today, as you know, is the tension that exists right now all throughout the country on college campuses, but really in the larger culture, around the issues of free speech versus equal protection in the face of hate speech and hate content, whether it's racist, homophobic, Islamophobic, misogynist, whatever the case might be. And as we know, these issues of free speech are roiling the nation right now, whether we're talking about taking a knee in the NFL, whether we're talking about ABC canceling Roseanne's show this week, whether we are talking about the President of the United States demanding that Samantha Bee be fired from her show because of a comment that she made about Ivanka Trump the other day. These discussions of what can we say and when can we say it, what are the proper limitations perhaps on freedom of expression, or if there are to be no limitations on freedom of expression, nonetheless, how can we respond to racism, to sexism, to various forms of oppressive language? And I wanted to ground this discussion before we get started and look at some of the specifics of what's going on campus and how we deal with this. I wanted to ground it in a recognition that regardless of what you think about free speech and the First Amendment, there are serious issues in play about the creation of equitable campus climates in this country. And these are issues that schools have to grapple with that are not just legal issues, right? The free speech and First Amendment subject is a legal issue that lawyers fight over and that the courts have said what can and cannot be done. But beyond the legal, we have to have a conversation about not so much free speech, but the consequences of speech. Because just because speech is free doesn't mean that it has no consequence, right? Some people apparently believe that free speech means that they can say anything without even being harshly criticized, right? Because if you harshly criticize them, which is actually you expressing your own free speech, that somehow you're being oppressive or that that amounts to censorship. So that is an important issue. We need to recognize also
that people's words and actions can be and are often weaponized against the most marginalized peoples in our society, and that speech acts do not take place on a level playing field. So even if we agree fundamentally that free speech is such an important value that we really ought not place any content-based restrictions on it, and that's a respectable position that good folks can take, we still have to acknowledge that speech acts don't take place on a level playing field. So that if someone uses the N-word against a person who is black, it is different, frankly, than when someone calls a white person like myself a cracker. See, the thing is, when I say the word cracker, people sort of giggle. Because it doesn't have the historical umph, it doesn't have the backing of an oppressive state. It's not a nice word. I don't recommend using it. I don't like it when people, but honestly, like, it doesn't wound in the same way because it doesn't have a history. And so we have to understand the unlevel playing field if we're going to create some type of real dialogue around these issues. And I want to start with David about this, because here we have a person who curates a museum that is dedicated to demonstrating the way that words and images have been used to denigrate. So you know, David, quite well that messages have real impact. They create a climate where oppression can become more possible. They're not just neutral flotsam and jetsam floating around like, oh, words don't hurt and it's no big deal. Words and images can hurt. How should we understand the power of words and images and symbols historically when it comes to undergirding racism, if you'd like to start with that?
All right. Well, thank you. I was sitting here trying to figure out how to not make this about me, so I'll tell a story about me.
Makes sense.
Yes, makes sense. So I was giving a talk in Brighton, Michigan, which is just outside of New York, and it's one of the communities where you had a lot of whites who left Detroit. And the radio host there decided to tell people not to come hear me, that I was a troublemaker, and I was going to provoke people, I was going to use bad language, I was a hater. And in one of the rare instances that I know of, it worked. Only one person showed up. And that poor fella got it all. You would have thought I was speaking to 1,000 people. But it made me think a lot about a couple things. One, I don't think we should ever disinvite people to places. If you invite the people, then let them come. Secondly, I think that what we need to do is have other spaces. And so, for example, when Ben Shapiro came to our campus, we made a couple conscious decisions. We would not provoke him. That we'd listen, because there are voices on our campus that wanted to hear him, and that we'd be respectful, and it went without incident. The third thing, and more directly to your question, we have an advantage in the Jim Crow Museum, which is we have racism in our name. And so when people come there, they expect to be engaged in a meaningful way about really, really difficult things. Even so, we have folk who are uncomfortable with certain conversations. The fourth thing I'd like to say is I'm a little concerned or always mindful that when we put rules in place to prohibit or to stop people, that those same rules can be used against people that we want to hear. I can't tell you, Tim, the number of people who would rather we not have a Jim Crow museum, who, when they look at a lynching tree, or they look at segregation signs, or some of the literally thousands of anti-black caricatured pieces, they just as well, those things did not exist in a public space. And so then the burden is on us to make sure that they are properly contextualized and that we have built-in dialogue. I know it sounds trite, but I still believe, even after all these years, I still believe in the triumph of dialogue, and that we can engage even in painful discussions in this in the U.S. So sorry for the long answer.
No, that's a great answer, and it actually leads to a follow-up that I want to get Mike and Loretta in on. You made a point about the importance of contextualizing hateful material, and I think that's the beauty of a museum. It's the beauty of textbooks. It's the beauty of a semester-long class where we have day after day or week after week, we can talk about these really serious things. And I'm wondering, and I want to get y'all's opinion on this, is there a difference, though, between that and saying that people who make blatantly racist remarks, not in a contextual way, not in a way that we're going to be able to think about and talk about and learn about the way that you can in a museum, if it's Milo Yiannopoulos, if it's Richard Spencer, even more to the point, coming to the University of Florida calling for a white ethnostate, I'm not sure, I don't know for sure, but it seems like that's like it's hard to contextualize. He's not a museum. He's just a walking Nazi troll who comes to places and says hateful things. Now, I'm not saying that therefore he ought not be allowed, and I'm not saying that necessarily, but what I'm saying is there a difference between the carefully constructed contextual discussion of hate and bigotry that might still trigger folks, might still hurt, but we can deal with that, we can sit with that, and somebody who comes in for the explicit purpose of frankly causing pain. Like there's a sadistic element to what Richard Spencer and what Milo do, and I'm wondering if it's different to you all.
I'm at Hampshire College, and I was at Hampshire College, and I teach a course called White Supremacy in the Age of Trump. And one of the things that I teach is the whole process of holding the First Amendment responsibly and not furthering the goal of white supremacy in your irresponsible handling of the First Amendment. There is a way to respect the First Amendment and to respect people's right to be free from racial and gender terrorism. You can actually hold those conversations at the same time and not have them exist as a false binary. First of all, I teach the students, what is the value of no platforming? Meaning you don't have to use your resources to provide a platform. The New York Times gets millions of letters. They don't publish them all because they have control of their platform. They decide whether or not their platform can be used. ABC decided whether or not their platform could be used. We do have those rights to not provide those spaces. Yet we're told, often as the victims of racial terrorism, that we don't have that right not to provide people those spaces, but we do have those rights, and it takes courage to stand up to them. The other thing I teach my students is to use it as a teachable opportunity when a hate group or a hate speaker is trying to come to campus. I said, instead of protesting them, which is the normal reflex action most students want to do, why don't we monitor them, take photographs of them, investigate them, prepare dossiers on them, inform the university leadership the risk attached to having this person, the financial cost it has attached to having this person. Give them evidence, not just feelings and passion, but evidence that can inform their decisions. And what that does is make the students on the campus feel totally empowered to control the narrative, to control what happens as a consequence of the administration's decision, as opposed to just be reactive protesters and then giving the white supremacists what they want, which is a chance to claim victimhood status. And then the last thing I'll say about what an opportunity it is, we can always use it as an opportunity to teach about the First Amendment. I found articles as early as the early 20th century where white folks argued that their protection of the First Amendment doesn't matter if it costs black people their lives, because the principle is more important than the lives it costs. So this is something that has been going on for centuries, and we can provide that historical information to students as well so that they make an informed, sophisticated reaction when a hate group or a hate member comes to campus, as opposed to reactive, let's just beat them up, let's just shout them down kind of stuff. I think they trap us in that kind of ineffective response as a way to continue the white supremacist narrative, and I'm into deconstructing it.
It's interesting, right? So I'm at the University of Puget Sound, and I'm over in the Pacific Northwest, and I've learned that, after spending some time there, that the Pacific Northwest is really more passive-aggressive than the Midwest, which is aggressive-passive-aggressive, especially when the race conversation comes up, right? I think about the colonial relationship that still exists. At the end of the road, these are not institutions that were built with people of color in mind, with trans people in mind, with people of different ethnicities or religions or faith outside of the white supremacist patriarchal norm in mind. So we have to understand how to historicize that in the context of a world where it still follows its missions, values, policies that play off of that foundation. So colleges don't operate in legal ways by way of how they cultivate communities. We have community standards. There's a faculty code of conduct. There is a student code of conduct. There is a staff code of conduct. And really digging into that policy and that discourse is important in assuring that that's presenting in a way where everybody, particularly in 2018, is contributing to and reconstructing what that discourse looks like. And I have to remind people all the time, here is the only place where every 4 to 5 years you get, in our case, 2,600 new students. In many other cases, it's maybe, 17,000 new students. You cultivate that, eventually they become seniors, they are leaders, right? Then they leave, and you recultivate. Every year you have to do the work over and over and over again. I really want to hone in particularly on not restricting what that free speech looks like, but really reframing the language of respect, because at the end, we are educators, and most folks, if they're relying on the TV and the media and the town around them and what they know, and that's what they're bringing to the college, they are going to say some really dumb shit. All the time. The one thing I will say about this is this. I personally don't have an issue if I stood across some cat who is talking all this junk and a lot of that irrational nonsense that comes with the discourse they're spitting. Because for me, I'm an educator first and foremost. That said, here's where I draw the line. A lot of folks today, their problem in there is they don't like to be called racists, right? They come, they're like, I want to report that I went to see this person and I said something and they called me a racist, and that's bias. And I have to explain, like, look, nobody is stopping you from speaking your mind, but please understand that what you're saying is incredibly racist, and if that's how you're showing up, that's how you're going to be deemed. You can't get mad at folk because they don't want to mess with you no more because you're saying some really racist stuff.
The context piece, I want to stick with this for just a second, because I do think when we have incidents on campus, and we'll get back to the whole issue of no platforming speakers, because I want to go and spend some time with that also. But the issue of, let's say, racialized incidents that may or may not be overtly intentionally racist, but are clearly racialized in terms of their impact, are not all the same, right? Not all incidents are created equal. Someone who's putting hateful graffiti on someone's residence hall door is obviously engaged in an act of direct harassment. And I don't know of any court that actually says that that kind of act is protected. Likewise, if you follow a student around the campus and shout homophobic slurs at them, misogynistic slurs, transphobic slurs, racist slurs, that's a direct harassment. No court is going to say that you have the right to do that. On the other hand, let's think about some of the incidents that, some of the schools here represented might have had, certainly many have, where students at Halloween, right, will dress up in incredibly offensive Halloween costumes. They may be blackface related. They may be the wearing of indigenous Native North American quote-unquote costumes, which is its own problem, right? To actually refer to the clothing and the dress of indigenous peoples as costume in the first place is itself indicative of something problematic, right? But people will do this. Now, some are doing it out of sheer ignorance, because they come from that place where they don't have exposure to either the history of indigeneity or connection to people of color. So they're acting out of pure ignorance. Now, the purpose of college is in part to undo ignorance. So in that situation, maybe we could say, look, we got to do some restorative justice with this person. We got to do some work with this person, and this person can be redeemed, and it's partly our job to do it. On the other hand, you have folks who might be engaged in a blackface incident on MLK Day, where they're doing and performing racism in a very overt and conscious way. And so that becomes a different kind of thing. How do we know where the lines are? Can we draw the lines, or do we just have to go through this on a case-by-case basis, trying to figure out as best we can when an act is an act of real harassment with malicious intent that might violate some other part of the conduct code? About how students are supposed to comport themselves, et cetera? Or do we just have to drop the hammer on all of that or allow all of that in the name of free speech? How do we know where the lines are? David, you want to start with that?
Well, I was just thinking, I hope he doesn't start with me.
Well, I did.
Well, I've spent my adult life tracking things like blackface parties, south of the border parties, so-called MLK parties, pimp and hoe parties, and the like. I don't like giving up on people. Again, as I said before, and it sounds so trite, I do believe in the triumph of dialogue. I know that some things are not well thought out. I'm also the Vice President of Diversity and Inclusion, and one of the things I've done is I've been part of the punishment for people. And so sometimes when people engage, they misbehave. Part of their punishment is a conversation with me. and so we talk. And I'm pretty good at one-on-one discussions like that in my office. But you know what I've found a lot of times, again, the person is not thinking things through. Every now and again you get a hate-filled, mean-spirited person. And I don't want to give up on them either, but it, you know, quite frankly, you're not going to reach them. You asked a question about case by case. Yes, of course, everything is going to be case by case. I do want to make a comment, though, about the hate speech piece. You're right about harassment, but one of my big disappointments as we try to deal with hate speech on our campus is, Tim, there's just quite a bit you can get away with. And we've had lawyers tell us that our hate speech codes are in violation and that there's no hate speech codes in the U.S. under the student conduct piece that you would win in court. And so what it has done is make me try to find other ways to reach people. Again, mindful of the fact that anything we put in place is going to go both ways, right? So if you say, for example, I'm good back to the speakers for a minute. If you say that, like Michigan State did, that you're designated to a certain space, I think they put Spencer like in an old cow palace kind of thing. You could still smell the shit from the cows. From the
right.
They also did it like in a break, you know, like, you know, when most of the students weren't there.
Yeah.
But then I started thinking, okay, then if we're going to be fair, then we're going to have to do that with anyone who's provocative. I don't want that kind of campus. I sound like somebody that's idealistic. I truly believe people can engage in ideas while at the same time acknowledging that some folk are just up to no good. And so then the balance becomes like one of our core values is ethical community. We have people who fly in, they say the worst things imaginable, they get their checks, and then they get on an airplane and they leave, and we're still here. We're still at our campus. We're still living with the fallout. That's kind of the same conversation that I have with our students, and I say to them, this campus belongs to all of us. It's not just your campus. You know, our founder, who I have a great deal of respect for, created a campus for all the boys, all the girls, all the men, all the women, in all the states, all the time. That's six times saying all. So it's also yours. But it doesn't belong to you any more than it belongs to anyone else. And try to engage folks in that kind of conversation. So it's just really, really tough. I don't want to draw lines because I think people hide behind lines once they're drawn. What I want to do is engage each of the situations, engage each of the people, and challenge them, push them.
Well, I have to say my job is paying attention to the no good, the folks up to no good. So I don't necessarily take a fair and balanced kind of false equivalence view of these people because I know they are about resurrecting Nazism. This is not just about free speech. It's about a right to be alive. And because I've deprogrammed white supremacists in my career, I know that there are some people who are much more dedicated to hate than to reason. And so those are not the people that I'm going to be calling in the first place because there is no reaching them. There is no dialogue with them. The only dialogue they want with me is a bullet going in my chest. So let's be clear that everybody is not reachable, that there are people who I call the muddled middle that can go either to the left or the right, and I'm going to have strategies for them. But if they're in that 25%, that are unreachable, I have a different strategy for them. And it's not one based on simple dialogue. So we need to maybe understand and more appropriately choose our targets. So that's one thing. The other thing that we have to acknowledge is that the same time that our campuses are being roiled around anti-black, anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim stuff, they're also being roiled by anti-Semitism as well. And so we have to have conversations about that as well so that we can be in defense of the Palestinians without being in violation of anti-Semitism. We've got to figure out how to teach that and hold those two conversations. And so in closing, I just want to say my contribution to this conversation as an expert on hate groups and white supremacists, and that's how I met you, Tim, when we were fighting against David Duke getting elected here in Louisiana and stuff, is that We have to learn to build a stronger human rights movement by calling in the calling out culture. That's the name of my next book. We need to be united against fascism. We can think many different ideas and still build a united human rights movement. But I don't want a impotent response to fascists. I don't want people to think that the fascists are playing by the same rules that we have respect for and revere. They are not. They never have, and they never will. And we can get hoisted on our rules while we get eliminated by their genocides. And that's very important to draw a distinction.
So when I think about strategies, right, there's definitely a line for me. When I think about code of conduct, one of them is personal safety, right? So if someone crosses that line of personal safety, yeah, they gone. That's where I'm really going to fight pretty hard. Make sure somebody is, period, gone, and have done so before. It's not pretty, but right, there's a difference when you start to cross that boundary. The other one is damaging property, right? And there's other situations where, you know, people come and say something like, Mike, you got to kick this person out. They're wearing a Trump hat or a hat that says, Make America Great Again. And I'll get about three or four of those, and I have to respond and say, you know, like, I get it. That's, you know, it's hurtful. It's messing with you. It messes with me, too. There's some serious issues there. But we can't go kick somebody off campus because they're wearing a hat that supports, you know, Donald Trump. And in that sense, I think that we also have a responsibility to the invitation to community. When we invite students onto our communities, our campuses, we are telling them for the past year or so that they're welcome, that we're going to foster an environment for them, that we're cultivating a climate that they're going to feel safe. And in that sense, we need to follow through. So that's part of the strategy, is how do we think about that invitation to community? And so when you invite people to community, for me, that's my approach. Going back to kind of restorative justice, you also invite with the understanding that there's a reconciling and a reckoning and a redressing that goes on with the invitation to people onto your community that you have to engage. Because at the end, that is what you say your mission and vision and the goals of your institution are, both outside and within the curriculum. And that's such an important piece and element to the work.
Staying in that higher ed context for a second, and the issue of mission and accountability to one's mission, I want to give you a hypothetical, and it's not really a hypothetical. It's actually a real-world example, but I'm going to sort of hypotheticalize. That's not a word, but I'm pretty sure white privilege lets me just make shit up. Yeah, I think I can just inserted a new word into the dictionary because I can. Anyway, so several years ago, I was giving a talk at Bellarmine University, which is in Louisville. And at the time, there was a controversy because there was a young man there who was walking around campus and had been for a semester at that point with a white supremacist armband. It wasn't a swastika, but it was a symbol of South African white nationalists and mm-hmm. neo-Nazis.
Like
and
Dylan Roof.
Yes, very much like Dylan Roof. Mm-hmm. And he was also wearing clothing from like white power skinhead music bands and things like that. And now this was a private institution. This is a Catholic college. And legally, let's be very clear, there is a definite difference between what private institutions have to put up with versus what public institutions have to put up with. So in the case of Bellarmine, they were free to, if they so chose, they were free to ask him to find another place to matriculate and to graduate. Public institution would not necessarily have that same freedom. I, at the time, weighed in on the side of removal because, frankly, the fact that he is a, you know, confused young man who needs the loving, healing balm of a sociology department, to me, did not...
Not going to get it from the sociology department.
Right. To me, might be true, but for him to get his healing at the expense of black and brown students on that campus, and even some of the Jewish students on that campus, even though it's a Catholic school, there were some Jewish kids there, is asking an awful lot. It's asking black and brown and Jewish folks to spend their life to fix that guy. And in a private institution, I'm not sure that was necessary. Now, the hypothetical I want to throw out to you, though, is I'm almost certain, even though I'm not a lawyer, that if that had been a public institution, their ability, because he wasn't directly harassing anyone, he wasn't saying and doing racist stuff, he's just walking around being an asshole, for the most part, with this racist armband, I have a feeling that he would not have been able to be expelled or removed for that. So then the question is, if that is an option that regardless of whether it ought to exist, it doesn't in a lot of our state institutions, then what can we do? Because we obviously can't just remain silent. So what are the things we can do short of that, right? Rather than thinking of it as a binary, either restrict or total free speech, what are some other creative ways to respond to incidents, to individuals that will perhaps even be more effective and more movement building, going back to something Loretta said, than simple restriction? Because restriction of speech, even if it's legitimate in a certain situation, doesn't build movement. Mm-hmm. It just sort of puts out the fire in that moment. We have to do more than that. So what would be, in all of your estimations, and we'll go back this way, starting with Loretta this time, what are some things we can do when that kind of thing is happening on campus that are creative responses to someone like that, that individuals can do, that the institution itself can do to make sure that the preservation of equity and the preservation of safety for marginalized peoples is still there?
My experience shows me that a lot of people enter the Nazi movement out of a sense of alienation, out of a need for attention. Sometimes they get bullied and they find that once they put on the Nazi uniform, people become afraid of them. So there's a whole lot going on in that individual that you actually can attend to if you choose to. And so one of the things that I find sometimes effective, but it's not a hidebound rule, is to engage that person in conversation to try to get at some of those motivations for why they think the Nazi regalia or the Aryan Brotherhood or the Afrikaner stuff is something that they admire and what was going on that made them make that turn instead of a different turn in life. There's usually a story, because no one comes out of the womb wanting to be a hater. That is something that is socially produced, and so you can pick at those things. Now, I do get a lot of trolls, which is kind of funny, and so you have to use discernment. Sometimes people troll you because they want attention. They want to get your name in Campus Reform. They want Turning Point USA to come after you, those kinds of things. And so you have to be able to do a threat assessment with competence. You just can't just say, I'm going to do all this or all that. You really have to use a much more rigorous analysis of how to respond to an individual troll or a trolling organization on your campus. At the same time, you can also use the greatest weapon in your arsenal. People begging for attention are deeply wounded when they get ignored. Are deeply wounded, kind of like our president. The only thing he can't stand is someone ignoring him, you know, kind of thing. And so you really have to choose your weapons. I also find it useful to use that person's presence on campus to educate the rest of the student body. And students have a way of doing peer pressure in a way that no faculty or staff or administrator will ever get to. They can certainly create ways to challenge that person's perception and make them feel like an exile on their own campus. This is what young people do with each other. I don't want to lose sight of the humanity of the person in the MAGA hat or the swastika, stuff like that, because they're human beings who have human rights I have to fight for too. But at the same time, I don't let them become terrorists on campus because I'm afraid of confronting them.
What I've been seeing, at least with respect to a lot of the student population showing up, particularly white students, is that they're showing up, you know, with this narrative, right? This, they're taking our stuff and they're taking over the land and we're becoming less because everything is being given to them. And all those narratives, there's a resentment that exists there that is false, but it's a resentment nonetheless that you have to also invite in through that intentional dialogue, particularly to data. There's a real conviction about this work. So part of what we do is when we invite them on to the community, we right from the back address the presumption of free speech and what that looks like, right? And already set a tone, again, going back to that community standard, that to me is such an important piece. For example, right at the beginning, one thing that I do is I work with the community to have 5 programs right off the back to have these conversations. What is bias and hate? What does it look like on campus? How are we having the conversation? But proactively having those conversations. 2 other conversations that I kind of laid out and set up, 2 per month, is how national issues trickle into our local community. And contextualize that for students very, very proactively. Invite the faculty across different disciplines to also be part of that mix. Be incredibly contextual and intentional about what that educational programming looks like. Don't wait for it to be reactive. And then the other part of that is reminding through that programming is what are the institutional's responsibility to the public good, even in the privatized setting that is a campus community for private institutions, that is still about meeting the needs for the public good. And I'm also going to say that for faculty who are tenured, who have so much freaking power, who don't step up to the plate, who need to step up to the plate in that same form of solidarity when those issues happen. A moral obligation to each other is essential for that type of happening to take place in our campus communities.
David, any thoughts on that?
A couple things. One, to your direct question, what I would say is, I mean, we have a threat assessment team. I'm aware of their findings, their investigations. Sometimes a person has to leave the institution. So that's just a direct answer to your question. I would like to push a little bit back in this sense. So many times when we talk about free speech, like we just take the most extreme examples. So we end up talking about Nazis. And again, I founded a museum. I've spent my life fighting organized hate groups and also unorganized hate in this country. But I don't want to diminish the fact that's significant. But in the everyday course of things, it's more impacting my work, just people that share sentiments with Nazis, not necessarily Nazis or who are at least on that side. So I don't want to lose sight of that. The other part of this is, I believe you can create a campus where at least a lot of the hate or hating, the person can actually feel uncomfortable. That is so, you know, again, now sometimes you get a pushback, and it's kind of a sociological piece where sometimes the instances of hate go up as we make progress, if that makes sense. Sure. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of a weird barometer of the progress. So you build an LGBT center, all of a sudden instances against LGBT people go up. So, right. But I believe you can create a campus that is welcoming. I think let's just rewrite every mission in the U.S. On every college campus that, and succinctly something like this, that everybody here will believe rightly that this campus belongs to them as much as it belongs to anyone else. Mm-hmm. And let that be the everyday functioning push of the institution. I think you can do that. I think it certainly ought to be what we're trying to do. Now, we are going to have situations, although, you know, you were mentioning about the student with the Nazi insignia. There are a lot of students walking around our campuses with shit on. I don't like, and it's not all racial. I mean, but there's freedom. There is some of that. And so I want to be a campus where we can engage people. But to get back to the original point, there are instances where our team decides that a person would be better at this point in their journey being someplace else. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Loretta, you said something you wanted to jump in real quick.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to you, David. Obviously, everybody who has sucked into the ideas of the white supremacists or the Nazi movement is not actually a card-carrying member of the Klan or the neo-Nazi movement. I mean, not all white people are white supremacists, and not all white supremacists are white. But I do want to say that part of the reason so little progress is made is because we get caught up in name-calling and identifying the right nomenclature rather than going to the problem. The problem that underlies all of that. And that is a very academic response. Let's talk about using the right word versus let's talk about the sentiment underneath those words kind of thing. Because we feel safe talking about nomenclature. We don't feel safe talking about hatred. Mm-hmm. And that's something we have to resist as academics, mm-hmm. you know, to stay in our comfort zone rather than be pushed out of them. And the thing that strikes me, since I go to about 10 or 20 campuses a year giving lectures and teaching and stuff, is how poorly prepared our campuses intentionally are to deal with white supremacy. Mm-hmm. It's not an accident that campuses have 65-page documents on dealing with gender oppression and a paragraph in dealing with racial oppression. That's not an accident. And so we have to call those issues out and force campuses, faculty, staff, administrators to hold and be accountable for their power. Mm-hmm. You know, for these 250,000, half a million jobs, dollar jobs, and you freeze if someone calls you a racist, that means that you're not qualified for that job. Because racial incidents happen on every campus every year. And if you're ill-prepared to deal with them, get the hell out the way so someone qualified for the job can hold it.
Right. Well, that piece and what David said, I think, are both so critical in that if you create a certain climate and you take away the option of ignorance to some extent, you take away the option of opting out of this conversation, you do that through orientation programs, you do that by what I just am thinking about when Loretta made that comment, is if you build in a commitment to and experience building equitable spaces into the job requirement, right into the actual, like, this is part of your gig, and as a student, this is part of what it means to be qualified to go here, is a certain awareness, then you start to weed out, to some extent, not perfectly, right? But you begin to weed out those people who want to come and cause trouble and just troll and be racist, because they're going to know, like, this is not going to be, I'm going to be not only outnumbered, but I'm going to be in a place where everybody's about some stuff that I'm not about. So part of it's about creating that. Now, that brings up something, though, that I want to ask you about, because this is what happens. We a lot of times in this country, we get in this free speech versus hate speech versus censorship versus whatever debate, and it's always about the attacks, quote unquote, on right-wing people. Mm-hmm. But what has happened on a lot of your campuses and our campuses is when we try to do some of this preventative stuff, the training, the orientation programs, the discussions in Res Life, whatever it is to try to set a different tone, then we have people on the right trying to attack your schools for instilling some type of authoritarian political correctness, white guilt, blah, blah, blah. We rarely ever talk about the attacks on free speech coming from the right against progressive voices, right? That whole narrative isn't even there. So you think about just a few examples, and then I want to get y'all's take on this. You have Stephen Saleta denied a tenure-track position at the University of Illinois because of his advocacy for Palestinian liberation. You have George Ciccarello Marr at Drexel, who got death threats starting a year or so ago after he had made some provocative Twitter posts that were completely misunderstood, deliberately so, by people on the right. He ended up being run out of that job. There have been over 100 incidents, according to the American Association of University Professors, of death threats leveled against professors in just the last year or so, and overwhelmingly, they have been left-leaning and progressive professors. Loretta referenced very briefly a second ago a campus watch. There's also a professor watch list started by right-wing millennial activist Charlie Kirk, who says, quote, "Our goal is to expose and really profile professors that have engaged in outward radical behavior. We're not saying these professors should be silenced. Instead, we're pointing out what has become a systemic problem where professors are able to say things that are completely outrageous." And he goes on to say that if they get death threats, that's too bad. It's not people like him. It's not their fault for exposing their quote-unquote radicalism. So then the question is, how do we insulate ourselves when we try to do the right thing, when we try to create the climate that will diminish the likelihood of fascist activity on the campus, not get rid of it, but diminish it? How do we then insulate ourselves to some extent on our campuses from these attacks? How do we fend off these attacks? And how do we make that part of the narrative? Because right now, that's getting lost completely. The only people who claim to be free speech martyrs are people like Milo Yiannopoulos and Ben Shapiro and Richard Spencer, when in fact, it is left-leaning professors, faculty and staff that are under the gun literally and figuratively much more often. How do we bring that out into the consciousness? Mikey, you want
to
start?
I'm just so used to normalizing critically what these conversations look like on my campus. And yeah, always being under the gun. That is Tim. That's the story of my freaking life.
Right.
That said, diversity and equity work is not meant to be easy. Never was. Never will be. You have to be a particular type of peace warrior to take on that work, that space, that place, and understand what the ancestors have left you with for you to do that work.
This is right.
And so when we show up in the spaces, we have to show up not only with that understanding, but that throughout our whole lives, this is what we've been preparing for that now moment that we're experiencing, no different than they did in the McCarthy era and then the Nixon era, and everybody thought shit was just going to fall apart and the world was going to end, and here we are again. So that is to say at the end that this is the work. It's a conviction that comes with it.
I mean, this is not work that is supposed to be easy. And I'll, if you don't mind, I'll tell you, we were meeting years ago, people in our jobs were meeting at the University of Virginia. And by the way, I have a lot of respect for the our counterpart at the University of Virginia, who after all they went through, he and I spoke on the phone, and he basically said to me, here are the 15 things you don't do. Okay, and it was a very honest, and it helped us, right? But we were having a chief diversity officer slash VP, diversity inclusion, whatever, discussion, and someone said, they started complaining about the personal attacks on us, complaining about people impugning our motives, complaining about not enough resources, complaining about the institutional systems of inequity at the institute. It just, it was overwhelming. And one person said that that is an occupational hazard. And someone else said it better. He said, no, it's not an occupational hazard. It's the occupation. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it like that, that's the work. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, all the crap, all the people who stand in your way, the folks who undermine you, the people who smile in your face and do bad things when you're not around, and yet that itself is the work. They are the work. Mm-hmm. They'd be insulted if you put them on your CV as the work. but they are the work. And so we accept this responsibility. And here's the other piece. We not only accept the responsibility, but to not see it as a burden. So we're in these positions for a reason. You know, people got beaten so we could be in these positions. And now that we're in these positions, it's our responsibility, not burden. It's our responsibility. So when I see the things that are occurring on that campus, or those campuses, the examples you mentioned, you know, it's already decided what side I should be on. And I'll give you this one little piece at my school. I had my position for 1 week when students with disabilities came in complaining. I didn't even know some of the issues. I'd had the job for 1 week. That same week, I was outside. I'm an administrator at our school. I was outside with a sign saying bad things about the administration. My administrative colleagues were like, that's not the way we do it. You know, you're supposed to be inside. But I was outside with them because that's where I was supposed to be.
That's right.
And when we have Black Lives Matter, I'm wearing black. I'm outside with them. And we have students who, that's so when we have faculty or staff, and we talk a lot about faculty, we don't talk about some of the injustices by some of the staff people. But when people are being mistreated, my responsibility, not my burden, my responsibility, is to be more than an ally. It's to suffer with them and to find a way to make things better with them.
One thing I found out about being at predominantly white institutions, that you can get sucked into a black hole of people agonizing over their privilege.
That's right.
And I have to look at them and say, you know, I'm used to people in pain because they don't have enough to eat. They're worried about getting deported, or they're going to get killed because they are trans. I'm not used to people agonizing because your job is hard and you get to sit on your butt all day and get paid $250,000 a year to do that. Get the hell over yourself. You know, I spent, like I said, I'm a white girl whisperer. And they agonize with the best of them over the really minor stuff. So that's just, I just needed to say that to discharge, because I have a lot of joy in doing my work. I love fighting white supremacy. It is not a burden to me. Like you said, I've got ancestors whose shoulders I'm standing on who prepared me for this moment. So ain't no way I'm not going to come up and stand up in this moment and have a whole lot of fun while I do it, because, you know, I've always believed that fighting Nazis should be fun. It's being a Nazi that sucks. So I'm all right with that. But I want to speak pedagogically. What we are failing to do as campuses is teaching how money contours white supremacy in America. I want to offer a course. I just thought of it up on the stage, so you're welcome to pirate my idea. I want to teach a course called From the Koch Brothers to Hobby Lobby, How Campuses Are Under Attack Nowadays. Koch Brothers, Hobby Lobby, to the DeVos family. How campuses are under attack nowadays. We should have that as a required course at every liberal college of America. So that we can stop being confused about this 50-year plan that Nancy McLean detailed in her book, Democracy in Chains. We should stop being surprised by a narrative that has been exposed to us. We should be proactively preparing for this moneyed attack on our college institutions and teach about it. Don't just say, oh my God, I'm under attack, I'm agonizing. No, you're in a war and you just found out that you actually have the best weapons available, and that is minds, logic, evidence, science, everything that they're afraid of.
Thank you. Thank you. So we got about 13, 14, 15 minutes left. I want to give some time for folks who might have a question of the panelists. We have a microphone up here. If you're physically able to get to the mic and want to ask a question, great. If you are not physically able to get to the mic, or if you're just someone who doesn't like standing in front of people and talking, I get it. I know that a lot of people don't like doing that, which is cool. You can raise your hand and just be loud, and or if you just don't want to cross the room, you know, we'll call on you.
So this may seem a little off topic, but today is the anniversary of the destruction of what's been called Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So here we are 97 years later, and especially when I come to this conference and I become more enlightened, I feel so frustrated. 97 years later, and we haven't, it feels like, even though we're not having towns torched anymore and destroyed, the needle hasn't moved nearly enough. What do we do?
Yeah, I thank you for that question. First of all, the thing we do is we don't forget. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm very pleased to see a number of documentaries out. We, of course, try to keep that story and many others alive in the museum. We don't forget. And I would suggest that what we need to do is challenge not just the U.S. in this sort of abstract conceptual way, but we need to challenge at the city, the county, at the local levels where we live. And we see in many ways that the composition of the people and the ideas on those boards, those chairs, those people reflect a sort of narrow group. So to make it more specific, city planners, people who are engaged in, I don't want to say like the chambers and this stuff, but people who are dealing with money, people who are giving opportunities for people to purchase land, or stopping people from being able to purchase land. We need to be having those debates, those discussions, to try to facilitate a situation where we can redo some of that, is my point. And some of it is as practical as having different ideas in zoning commissions, foundations. I haven't read recently, and maybe some of you can tell me, sort of the racial composition of the leading grant-giving organizations in the U.S.
Oh, I know.
Okay. Well, in other words, my point is that's another step. And when I hear you say that we haven't made some progress, I start thinking, what are the practical things that we can do? You know, we need seats at the table, and then when people get in the tables, seats at those tables, they need to make certain decisions, quite frankly.
And if I can just add one thing to that before we get another question, because this your question was so, it triggered in my mind something. Sometimes we think about whether it's Black Wall Street and the destruction of the Greenwood District in Tulsa, or whether we're thinking about the history of lynching, or we're thinking about the history of the splitting up of African families during enslavement. We think of these as historically frozen in time moments, mm-hmm. rather than connecting them to existing today similarities, right? So when you think of the bombing of the Greenwood District, okay, yes, gentrification isn't exactly the same,
right?
But the consequence is the destruction of Black community or brown community. When you think of the separation of immigrant children from their parents right now at the border, and as a result of ICE raids, it's not exactly the same as the splitting of African families on the auction block, but the consequences are quite similar, and the mentality that is behind both of those is the same. Black and brown lives not mattering, Black and brown communities not mattering. So I think part of it, too, is teaching
the history, not in this disconnected way that we normally do, mm-hmm. right, but in a way that is connected to the stuff that's going on right now. Because you ask any high school kid, like, their least favorite class is usually history because it seems disconnected from what's going on. And so part of it is about how we speak of these things, right?
All right. First, I want to thank you all. I really appreciate the wisdom that you've been sharing. I'd like to hear your thoughts on some of the more stealthy work that's happening, you know, that it has similar agendas to Yiannopoulos and Spencer and Duke and Trump, right? But I'm talking about, like, the Heterodox Academy and folks like that and what they're doing to push a white supremacist agenda in a much more stealthy, undercover way and getting support, and oftentimes from the nice white folks on campus that normally would be more behind a progressive agenda. So I'd just like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, that's one of the reasons that I teach students and faculty and administrators to trace ideas, not names, not personalities, but to identify white supremacist ideas no matter where they appear. And so you can't assume by somebody's name or their own self-identified brand that they have the values that we would support. You have to pay strict attention to the way the ideas of the far right get mainstreamed by the religious right, get economically justified by ultra-conservatives, and then get institutionalized and practiced by traditional bigots. You have to follow the ideas and not just the appendages of the name. But one of the things that I also teach is, what is white supremacy? White supremacy is the destruction of economic and social competitors for wealth. That's what it does. That's what it was designed to do from the beginning. And so don't be surprised if that's what it performs. I mean, it all started around Portugal trying to destroy Spain's wealth-producing capability and changed its whole economic relationship with Africa from a trade relationship to a conquest relationship. I'd love to teach you about it, but this is where it started. And so we need to talk about that. And then, David, you raised the point. As a director of Sister Song, we've done intentional work around foundation dollars and where they go and who makes the decisions about where they go. Let me first tell you the first big secret. They disguise their data because they don't want people to know how lack of diversity is in their funding decisions. They will hire program staff of color and still have the majority of the funding going to white people. They do it over and over again. We had our founder of Sister Song worked for 15 years at the Foundation Center trying to find out that data, and she was blocked at every turn by the foundations. The people of wealth do not want their white supremacy exposed, particularly if they're funders of the left. And so we have to do analysis on how funding hurts when you become part of the nonprofit industrial complex.
Let's try to have time for this one last question, and then we will be wrapping up.
So my question is about discussions. I grew up in St. Louis, less than 15 minutes away from where Mike Brown's life was taken away from him. And I was actually in St. Louis during all that time and involved in that work. So as a black man in America, as a black man in America from St. Louis, I'm no longer interested in discussing my humanity with somebody. If we can't agree that police fatality is an issue, I don't want to have a conversation with you. But I do realize and I recognize that we do need to be talking about these issues. So my question is, what advice do you have to have conversations around these issues?
I'm not going to ever tell a person that their level of frustration and angst shouldn't be so high that they should have this discussion. I believe in dialogue, but I believe this. I believe to be sane in the U.S. and to be a person of color, a black person in the U.S. and to be sane is to be sometimes angry. I believe it, to be black in the U.S. is to be surrounded by premature death. It is to be surrounded by measures of inequality for people that may not know the word inequality but feel it every day, whether they know the word or not. Given that circumstance, it's up to you to decide to what extent you want to participate in discussions and you to decide what those discussions are. And I pride myself on doing my own thinking. I don't know what left and right mean anymore, but I know I do my own thinking. I think you do your own thinking. You'll make the decisions about what kind of dialogues you want to have, when you want to have them, and how you want to have them.
I just wanted to offer you, of course, I'm very familiar with St. Louis. I've been there dozens of times. I recommend that as a young black man, you work with the Organization for Black Struggle there, OBS. Over on Rowan Street, 1401 Rowan Street. I really, I mean, that's what I, you know, I have respect when I can just quote you
advice. That's specific
advice. You need to go for what, because they have a youth group, they're youth led, first of all, but they work intergenerationally without any struggle, without any, so you got people my age, 70 years old, working with 12 and 13-year-olds around the racial struggle in Missouri, because Missouri is a plantation state if I've ever seen one. And I say that coming from Georgia. but it's like a state that had a riot but didn't and stuff. And so I really recommend that you look up OBS, the Organization for Black Struggle, in St. Louis, and you will find a lot of the answers and the mentors that you need because they are grounded in the community. I think they celebrated their 30th anniversary, and they were right there when Ferguson happened. Hmm. They were the ones right prepared. A whole lot of people parachuted in. OBS has been in the community forever.
And let me add one thing before we get out of here, and this is good advice, I think, for anyone. When you are under attack, whether it is by law enforcement, whether it is by neo-Nazis, whether it is by the administration of your government, or whether it's just some jerk on campus that's constantly engaging in microaggressions that you're having to put up with, you can't always be the one to have the conversation. As you're saying, you can't always be it. There are times you have to take care of yourself and remove yourself from the space. So the key is surrounding yourself, whether it is with an organization or at least a cadre of allies and supporters, that if it's Tuesday and you can't be there today for this, you can say to your allies and your friends, hey, I need y'all to handle this for a couple days. I need to go check out for a minute. And you can't feel, but sometimes we feel guilty about that, right? Because when we believe in justice and we're fighting for justice, you're not supposed to take a vacation. You're not supposed to take a break because people are dying and people are being deported and people are suffering. But here's the deal. If we don't pace ourselves and take care of ourselves and figure out how to do self-care, then we're going to die early, and that's more people are going to suffer because the movement's going to suffer for that. So you have that. You can't be there at all times and all places. Create community, build relationships, connect with organizations on the ground that can surround you with love and support and nurture you and get you back in the game, in the struggle, after you might have to take a couple of days of R&R, where you just need to decompress and do stuff and not think about this as much as possible. There's no way you can get away from it entirely, but not always be on a high burn, right? You just can't. You have to hand the baton off to people, and then maybe you come back and take it back from them when they get tired, you know? Listen, y'all, I appreciate you being here. I know we're a little over time. Could you please give a big round of applause to my guests?
That'll do it for this episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Be sure to join us next Tuesday and every week for yet another show. And look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Tumblr at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Podomatic, iTunes, Google Play, and of course, Patreon.com, where you can sign up to become a monthly sustainer of the show and receive extra bonus content unavailable anywhere else. For this episode, I'd like to thank Felicia Gustin, Jean Kayani, and Amalia Mesa Gustin at Speak Out, my producer Jamie Lynn Moeller, and of course, Brother Ali, for giving permission to use his song Gather Round as the intro and outro music for the program. And that is where we're headed now. Till next time. And the poor and the pious get inspired.